Hello, I am Cody Ullingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. This show is brought to you by Swarbricks, the first law firm in New Zealand to accept Bitcoin for legal services. The Swarbricks team are Bitcoiners, and they are knowledgeable about the legal aspects of Bitcoin in New Zealand, as well as general legal advice. Swarbricks offers a 20% discount for services paid in Bitcoin. Find out more at swarbricks.co.nz/Bitcoin. Now, in today's episode, I talk with Roland Buick, a Kiwi Bitcoiner and Lightning developer working on Albi and Lightsats. We talk about Roland's background and how he became involved in Bitcoin, how value for value and new kinds of revenue models for creators could work in the future, as well as the other possibilities that Bitcoin enables as the money of the internet. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. Otherwise, on to the show. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Good to be back in Thailand after the Indonesia Bitcoin conference. It was pretty tiring, but it was a shame I didn't make it to Japan. Pretty cool you got to see some of the Albi team there.
Yeah, Boomi and Quentin.
Nice. They say hi.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing, quite small world, one of our other team members, Jan, he actually owns two of your photography books. So,
that's pretty cool.
And he lives like in Germany, right? All the way across the other side of the world. So,
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, small world. But look, Roland, I do appreciate you making the time to catch up. It's really fortuitous. I'm in Tokyo or south of Tokyo at the moment. The Nostra Asia event was fantastic. And as I said, it was great to catch up with Boomi and Quentin and talk about Albi and what the project's about. And I really wanted to talk to you. Obviously, you're from New Zealand, but kind of, I guess, starting out sort of how you found yourself where you're at today, like your background. I mean, where did you grow up originally, Roland?
So I was born and raised just outside of Wellington. Went to college and university there. And yeah, I'm a programmer, so I've been programming for about 15 years now. When I was a kid, I used to play a lot of games with my brother as well. And I really liked this particular game, and I kind of got bored of it. So I was thinking, how can I make it fun again? I made some cheats for it, and eventually, decided to make my own game, and that's kind of how I got started with programming. But I kind of went through university, and then, started as a graduate developer. Junior developer, intermediate developer, kind of working my way up, the standard corporate ladder, I guess, and like decently sized companies. But I was learning a lot. I worked on a few cool projects, but I was not really ever fulfilled. And at the time, I was flirting with a couple of my good friends, and we were talking about, escaping the rat race, the 9-to-5. Passive income, digital nomads, all those sort of things. And there was one book that my friend gave me, The 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss. Not sure if you know it.
I've read it, yeah.
Okay. So, well, now I don't really believe in it. I think right now I'm working harder than I ever have and putting more hours in. But the kind of idea was quite appealing because what I was doing was not fulfilling, right? And so the goal for a lot of people was like early retirement, which is why after I kind of ascended to an intermediate developer, I decided I'm going to leave my job. I've got savings enough for a couple of years. So I decided to leave New Zealand. I'd been for one trip to Australia before, but I never... really kind of seen the world. So I decided to, take a plane, jump on a plane, come to Thailand because I had heard about the digital nomad culture here, like in Chiang Mai. I think I actually kind of missed the boat on that one. And I also kind of realized that I don't like moving around a lot. It's quite tiring, difficult, switching locations. I mean, it is a great experience, but for me personally, I kind of like, I like to find a nice spot to settle down and, be productive. So I ended up staying in Chiang Mai, trying to start a startup because that's the first time I was actually interested in learning a language. Coming from New Zealand, we know English. It's just like the main language of the world, the global language as we see it. I mean, we have Maori language back home, but it's so rare. I mean, if I went back, I would probably make much more effort to learn it than I did back then. But coming to Thailand, I that's the time, I really understood that how important it is to understand the culture. So that's the first time I was learning a language, and I looked at some different language learning apps, and none really fitted what I needed. So I kind of, created an app from scratch and tried to promote that, but unfortunately, it never really kicked off. My savings basically shrunk to zero over my time there, and I was basically doing whatever I could to, make ends meet, so that I didn't have to, like put my tail between my legs and kind of, take a flight back home. Especially like, my parents are quite old, so like the last thing I want to do is put pressure on them. So, I managed to get a few bounties with VLC Media Player, if you know them, and also a few found a few like just freelancing jobs online. Finally managed to find a US startup. So I worked in a small startup there and eventually actually became the lead developer for the startup. And for the first time in my life at that point, going from having absolutely no money to actually having some savings again, that's kind of when I started considering, right, like what should I do with my money? It's in the bank back home, like everything's going to New Zealand, paying taxes there, and interest rate, I don't know, I can't remember back then, less than 1%, right? And then COVID hits and the world just goes mad, basically, right? I was stuck in Chiang Mai in the middle of smoky season, kind of like the worst experience I've ever had. There were lockdowns there, the gym was shut. It's just completely covered in smoke for a couple months, and that's kind of the first time I, kind of started asking these difficult questions, like, what is the state? What's the role there? What is money? Like, how can they lock everyone down for 2 years? Like, completely stop production. Where is this money coming from? Is it loan? Is it from taxes? Is it money printing? And at the same time, as I said, I wasn't making any money from the savings in my bank, right? So I was looking at other options the first time, starting with, traditional investment. Because of COVID, like after COVID, if you invested at the right time, you could make quite a good return, right? But I had to have all this understanding of these companies I didn't know anything about. And I was basically, just making stabs in the dark. I didn't have time to research them. And internally, you have no idea what's going on, right? Unless you have inside information. So I kind of feel like that's more gambling than actually, smart investing. So that's kind of out. A lot of people in Thailand were talking about, cryptocurrency and investing there and like high returns and exactly the same thing. Like, how do you pick out of these 10,000, shit coins is exactly the same issue as traditional investment. So that's kind of how I finally found, Bitcoin, started going slowly down the rabbit hole. I guess I still have a bit further to go on my story, but do you have any questions at this point, I guess?
Oh no, this is great. You're giving me the blow by blow, and I think, Roland, I must admit, I think we have very similar stories.
Okay.
And I can really relate to that period of COVID lockdowns. I think a lot of us started thinking about things deeply and being introspective. And it must have been difficult for you to be locked out. And you said your parents were a bit older, so you wouldn't have been able to see them for like quite a period without going through the MIQ system, which was just a nightmare as far as I could tell. Is that right? You were locked out of the country.
Yeah. So I was really confused, right? Like how does the world completely shut down for this virus that has like a survival rate of 99.97% or whatever it is. Maybe it's a bit lower than that, but basically destroying the whole economy to save like the elderly and the sick, and the ethics around there. Because my parents, as you said, I couldn't visit home, and actually not sure if I wanted to in that time, because New Zealand was quite harsh, right, on the regulations there. Both of my parents and my brother, they called me, tried to push me to get vaccinated, ethically, protect your neighbors, protect people. And that was a really difficult time for me, I think, because I decided not to take the vaccine, and I was quite I felt like I wasn't helping people. I was quite selfish, I didn't manage to persuade them to, take a look at Pfizer, which I think had the biggest fine in history, right, for basically scamming with one of their pharmaceutical products. And at the same time, my colleagues, right, they were sometimes wearing masks on calls. They were debating on, which type of vaccine we should get, what's the best, the pros and cons. So it was actually quite a tough time for me, personally. So at that point, I was quite lucky though, because our US startup, because the economy basically crashed there, we lost our next round of funding. So I had more time. I think we still had some budget for work, but I had about 80% of time where I could just, work on my own projects. And that's when I was studying about Bitcoin and seeing the benefits there. And I wanted to see if I could, because I'm a programmer, see if I can create some apps that have Bitcoin in them and make some games with, some Bitcoin aspects or ways to earn Bitcoin, so that I can, share it with people and hopefully onboard people to this new superior monetary system. And I ended up working with my sister. So I haven't managed to orange pill her yet, but she's a great artist. So I did the programming, she did the art, and we made this game, which you could buy these characters using Lightning. So with Bitcoin, you can buy these in-game characters. And the game was quite fun. I liked it. But again, we never really just, achieved escape velocity there. We didn't have anyone helping us with, marketing promotion. But at the same time, I was on Stacker News. So have you used Stacker News, right? So I was really inspired at the time by I think Michael Saylor as well. How to decide whether a person is a bot or a real human in social media. So when you're on Facebook or whatever, you could get, or Twitter, you get 1,000 likes, right? You don't know how many of them are bots, how many of them are real. What is a like, right? So the difference here is Stacker News, when people post good content, they are upvoted with actual money, and that's impossible to fake, right? So it's basically putting money where your mouth is. And also, for creators who create value, they're able to receive and withdraw actual money, right, for the content they create. So I was really inspired there. I kind of added some of their ideas to this game I was working on. And also on there, there were posts about this upcoming Bolt Fun hackathon. So Bolt Fun is an organization which is trying to onboard as many developers as possible to use Bitcoin and Lightning and create, you know, new applications powered by Bitcoin. And Juan, the leader of our project, posted this idea on Stack of News, and he said, I want to make this simple app for onboarding new people to Bitcoin through tips. So rather than giving, you know, a cash tip, a fiat tip, you would give them a Lightning tip. And our solution would be that you give them the tip, we take them through onboarding, you know, the basics, what is Bitcoin, how to download a Lightning wallet, how to withdraw your tip to your wallet for self-custody. And if the user doesn't go through that flow, the tip that you give them, actually, after an expiry time, it will be returned back to your wallet automatically. So I thought that was a really cool idea. And because of this game I was working on, I already had all the, you know, expertise, I guess, to be able to actually create a prototype. And I'm pretty proud we actually made this prototype, a working prototype, within 3 days.
So that was Lightsats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when that came out, I was following the story, and I didn't know who you were at the time, but I remember using it and playing with it around the time of that. It was like a hackathon sort of thing, right? For the Bolt Fun website, which has a lot of these sorts of projects. And I remember seeing it, signing up to it, using it, and really loving it. And I was kind of at the time exploring how, you know, you could get people, you know, Bitcoin easily. And kind of demo things in an asynchronous way, because you can send them the thing and they don't have to do it straight away, right? It's sort of and I remember there was a design with it as well, so it was almost like a you know, there was this flow where you could you know, you could explain to someone how to use it, what, you know, and in their own time they could pick it up and start engaging with it. So I thought it was really great, man. And that was 3 days. You built that in 3 days, did you say?
The initial prototype. So yeah, at that point, basically you could send some of your Bitcoin to the Lightsat service and then give someone a link, and then they could basically claim this tip, and then the tip would be, they would be able to withdraw it to their wallet. But as you said, Juan, our leader, he managed all the marketing, advertisements, weekly updates. So he posted all the things we did throughout the journey.
Yeah.
And that's also where I met Renee. So we're a team of three, two programmers and one, our fearless leader. And so Renee is from Albi. That's kind of how I met the Albi team. Right at the beginning, when we started working on Lightsats, we had this call with Albi, because Albi actually does a lot of calls with, you know, these startup projects, random Lightning projects, developers, anyone who needs help or just minor feedback. And I think Rene at the time had just taken a year off, and he was coming back to work on Albi full time. And before that, he's like, okay, I just want to, you know, help with this hackathon. And that was really cool. So
yeah,
our skill sets are a bit different. He worked a bit more on the user interface, you know, the fine details, making it really nice and smooth for users. And I kind of focus a bit more on, you know, how things work behind the scenes, the back end stuff.
Yeah.
So in the end, we ended up winning the hackathon with a prize of one Bitcoin. And there's actually another one going on right now. So Volume 2, Legends of Lightning. And I think there's 3 Bitcoin up for rewards this time.
Yeah. The incentives, so, incentives make a big difference, don't they?
Yeah.
having some Bitcoin available up for grabs is going to make some people get motivated to build some amazing stuff.
Yeah, so I think there was over 50 projects last year. We'll see how many projects there are before the submissions end this year.
Yeah.
So
Just coming back to this game that you were talking about, what's the game called, if I may ask?
it's called Infinitris. So it's like Tetris, a really popular game. But it's like a multiplayer version, so you can play with your friends and just, well, there's different game modes, but the basic one is just you can, just place blocks together on this grid. So it's a bit different to the original Tetris, where you're constrained in, this little grid, like 20 by 10, 20 rows by 10 columns. But Infinitris is like the world wraps around, kind of like if you walk around the globe, if you believe there is a globe. There's kind of the same idea applies to this game. So it completely wraps around nice and smooth, and people can all place blocks together. So that's kind of the idea. But how I added lightning was that everyone has kind of the unique pattern on their blocks. So they can have a unique color, a unique pattern, and even like a friendly face, but not like, NFTs. But you can buy these characters using lightning.
Yeah.
They have no value outside of the game.
Yeah.
But that was kind of the idea. So,
That's cool. It's sort of, you're not shooting people. You're building stuff. That's cool. I like it. You're collaborating. I'm just curious about that. So you mentioned stack and use, value for value, something that's very close to my heart. And as we mentioned earlier, I've done some photo books, I've done different projects, and I certainly feel there's a real opportunity, and this is where I guess Albie comes in as well, around this creator economy and how creators, photographers, artists, different people can monetize their work in a Bitcoin world, in a way that just currently isn't possible. And I sort of always lament trying to use Instagram or whatnot, because it just is so empty. And I'm the one paying. If I want to have my work promoted, I've got to like boost it, or I have to get the blue check or whatnot. And it's really like the value is being generated by the users, and there's this central platform that's kind of consuming all of that value, shitting out ads, and just basically getting in the way. And obviously the Nostra conference last week was really great, to find out more about what's possible, with Nostra, but also more broadly, just value for value, as a concept and as a social movement. I think it's still early days, but I'm really excited for it. So, I mean, how do you see that unfolding? Like, you sort of been close to it with Albie. How have you seen this idea of value for value, and in particular, the way creators can use it? How have you seen that grow?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a superior monetization model. So I think there's three aspects to it: the developer, the creator, and the consumer. I guess we can start at the consumer first. It's the easiest to understand. There's no ads, right? For one, you have a closer relationship between the consumer and the creator. There's a lot more effort in creating, this relationship, this community between the creator and the consumer, because the creator has to receive these payments from the consumer, and the consumer has to willingly do that because all the content is free. So, how can you show, the contributors? Like, how can you do shout outs or display them? How you can set up, goals for a month, like how much money you want to raise. So yeah, back to the consumer, there's no ads, possibly no subscriptions. So, like the Netflix model, YouTube Premium, it doesn't matter how much you actually consume the content, right? You have a fixed fee every month, and most of that fee is going to the platform, not to the creators. And you don't know which creators they're going to, how that split works. So, value for value is a direct payment from the consumer to the creator with no cut, no middleman. You pay exactly what you feel is fair, and the user experience is so much better, right? And I guess same for the for the creator, actually. But there's a few other benefits as well, right? You don't need a bank account, you don't need a credit card. So I think I researched somewhere 1.7 billion people in the world still are unbanked, right? That's quite an amazing number. And all these people can easily set up, you know, start receiving Bitcoin. They can start creating, and there's no minimum, you know, minimum audience, minimum number of subscribers. You can receive instant payments. You know, there's instant settlement on Lightning. There's no chargebacks. You don't have to wait 30 days, 60 days to actually be certain that you receive some revenue. It's going directly to you. You don't have to, you know, bow down to these giant corporations and basically ask for your money. And also, because I'm a developer, I like to think from the developer's perspective as well. Lightning payments are just so much simpler, right? So you don't need to know any information about the payer. There's no need to collect credit card details. There's no need to change your user interface to be able to add ads, you know, different types of ads. What do you call them? Like interstitials, these forced ads. There's, you know, banner ads, all these things that you have to inject into your product, which basically destroys the UX, makes it more complicated, uses more bandwidth, poor user experience again. And also handling these payment providers is quite difficult, right? So Stripe, PayPal, there's no common standard across them. And that's one thing about Lightning. It's just a lot easier for the developer and for the creator. The consumer can pay without revealing any information about themselves, which is quite powerful.
Yeah. I guess a couple of thoughts on that. I was actually having a conversation with someone yesterday, you know, and you know, I'm back in Japan trying to take photos, trying to work on, I'm working on a book and a few other things and just creative work. And I think that the place that I've gotten to with social media is that fundamentally my creative work is, I mean, it's very artistic. It's sort of very niche. It doesn't necessarily have a mainstream appeal, though it's certainly, you know, I'm seeking out meaning making. And I guess kind of I've been trying to apply this Bitcoin lens to my photography and my work. And I realized, you know, one of the reasons, you know, I have had some success. So I've done the crowdfunding on Kickstarter with the, you know, with the photo books and you know, I've sold work commercially, but it's never been a driver for me. And I think a purely libertarian kind of approach to that would be, well, it's, you know, it's either an economic artifact or it's not, you know, does it exist purely in this sort of monetary capitalism system? But I think going beyond that, you know, recognizing there are actually different forms of capital and different forms of value. And there is a certain kind of artistic existential quality to certain things which make life worth living, which you can value them in sats or dollars, but they're not necessarily a widget or an item that can be easily transferred. And I think a lot of these things have conflated down to mean that you either have like broad spectrum content, you know, and I hate that word content, on YouTube, or and you've got, you know, enough subscribers to make advertising revenue, or you don't get anything. And there are some use cases where stuff like Patreon can kind of enable smaller scale artists to you know, to get more of that, you know, that patronage and that sort of that support from people who believe in the higher ideals of the work, without necessarily getting any kind of regular thing out of it. You know, it might be like, I just want to send you some money because what you're doing, the world needs. And I think I'm really interested in those kinds of conversations around how that can work, because you've got stuff like Geyser now as well, where you can do similar stuff to Patreon, but using Bitcoin. But I guess, you know, I'm wondering whether the value for value model really is one of many options that are available, because there may be work out there, and using the word content, there might be content out there that actually fits within an advertising based model, which in the case of my work, having, you know, an ad you know, my creative work, having an ad, you know, in between the photos, you know, that's not a very good UX. But there's other, you know, there's other models where you could have a mix of both. You know, maybe there's, you know, a very you know, concise and well integrated you know, sponsor or ad, you know, for example with this show, that is relevant to the audience, but then there's also a value for value component, or maybe it's one or the other, or different kind of combinations of it. I think that there's a lot to just think about there, but you know, how is it all changing? Now, I mean, we've got optionality now. You know, it doesn't all have to be ads, and I think that's probably the starting point from which we can start scaffolding new ideas around how an artist could fund their operation. You know, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, the quality of the ads is a lot more targeted, right? In your case, because you create Bitcoin related content and you have Bitcoin related ads. But I feel like, me personally, it would be nice for the consumer to be able to decide, rather than being forced, I guess. But I mean, in your show in particular, right, there's an ad at the start of the show, and then it's kind of like mostly an uninterrupted content. You know, you can take a walk or take a drive and just listen to the podcast, and you know,
you're not going to be pulled out of the moment with, you know, a break.
It's not like YouTube ads, right? And those are they're completely irrelevant, and at least the ones I see. And yeah, that, I guess that's my main issue. I think Bitcoin enables quite a few interesting avenues for ads as well. Being able to send transactions to random people, so you're paying to send them a message, basically, so they will receive an invoice, and in the invoice, the payment can contain a message saying, you know, check out this app or something like that. I think that's an interesting one, because you as the person who receives the ad is actually receiving value, right? You're receiving money. That's one interesting thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. The it sort of flips the model. So instead of just being eyeballs, it's like someone has to pay to get that ad in front of you. And I can see it almost flipping the funnel, you know, and so, you know, people will be kind of competing not to pay for the ad, but to pay the actual end user, because in a way, you know, with the sponsorship on this show, you know, we're very careful to look at, you know, what are the sponsors doing, you know, how are they operating, realizing some of the pitfalls that other podcasts have gone down, where they just sort of talk to anyone and get anyone, you know, anyone's money is okay. It's sort of like, well, what for the people who are listening, what would actually be valuable to them, and what's going to be helpful to them? And in a way, if you've actually got a product that someone wants, you know, and you're confident in that, you know, you can actually put some sats where your mouth is and send them a small message and develop a UX around how that works. And they might actually be like, hey, how did you know? That's exactly what I needed. You know, I've been searching for an eSIM to use while I'm traveling, and you just happened to message me this thing that's exactly what I wanted. You know, thank you. You know, as opposed to this like broad spectrum assault on the senses where you get sold some random ass stuff, you know, on a YouTube ad, which I haven't seen a YouTube ad in a long time though, man. I use like Brave and like different ad blockers and stuff. So I don't know, maybe it's, I'm a bit out of the loop, but whenever you go into like a new computer, like, you know, a new computer, and you like open up YouTube for the first time, and you see just the banal like toothpaste ads and stuff that are coming up, I'm like, man, your quality of life must go down as you see that stuff. Like,
yeah. So I think it's not really the problem with the models. I think you're right. There are ways to do it correctly. I think it's just the incentive structure is completely broken at the moment. So as you mentioned, advertising, rather than making the user be the product, basically, switching that so that the advertisement at the back is the product, right? Same with subscriptions. Like, if you subscribe directly, say I subscribe directly to you, the money that I'm paying to you is, you know, I'm willingly paying it. I know it's going to you. It's not going to some other platform. There's no big 30%, 50% cut. And sometimes value for value maybe is not the, it doesn't apply to all use cases, right? So there's still places where things like paywalls make sense, where you have to pay to be able to see the content. It really depends on the scenario. And I think the Lightning Network really improves that because, for again, instant settlement. So this enables some new use cases like, you know, AI. Originally, it's quite hard to start an AI company because if you do upfront work, so you need these, you know, you need a lot of graphics card, use a lot of electricity to run these AI models. And consumers can enter a credit card, receive this data, and then, you know, do a chargeback on their credit card. And the company that's, you know, providing the service, not only do they lose the money from the user, but they also get charged a fine, right, for the chargeback. So with instant settlement, you can receive the Lightning payment before you even start, you know, providing your service. And you can be guaranteed that you have received the money that can't be reversed before you provide the service back to the user. I think that one's quite interesting. And the other way around, users can also outsource their own, you know, their own graphics card to a service and receive continuous Lightning payments for the work that they provide every minute, for every single, you know, ChatGPT call, every question. You can use, you can earn money as a provider of the service. So I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think along those lines, the way Lightning works in particular, I'm really interested in that hyper global approach where things like APIs or any kind of microtransactions can be done through Lightning. And I think there's a subtle UX difference, which doesn't sort of make a lot of sense to people who don't really see it, but it's kind of like the horse and the car, you know, they kind of look the same if you're looking at it from like 1900, but they do sort of fulfill similar functions. You know, they got four things that help them move, you know, and four legs and four wheels, you know, it's like, oh, it's the same sort of thing. But there's a subtle difference, I think, with payments where instead of like having to get your credit card out, or even if you've got it like saved in the browser, the way that Lightning and stuff like Albi would just let you just seamlessly do it, it sort of removes these barriers. And because there's also no name attached to it, I think there's sort of this idea of like spam, or I'm actually using my debit card instead of my credit card, so I actually got to be a little bit more careful. I don't know if this is legit, you know, like there's things that you got to be careful about. Whereas with Lightning, it's like, because it is atomic, you know, there's no way for them to take more money from you. You know, like it's like a credit card number that's like pretty low security. Like it's like, in fact, there's like no security there. Like if they've got your number, they got you, you know, you need a new number at that point. Whereas with Lightning, there needs to be an action from the user to confirm that. And then it's like, that's one invoice, you know, there's no, unless you authorize some sort of recurring thing, there's no way to kind of get drained or maxed out or anything. I think, I mean, it'd be great to hear your technical perspectives on that. But my understanding is it's, you know, a lot more, you know, a transaction based. You know, you couldn't just pull all of the stuff in, especially with Lightning, you know. It's almost like you've, every time you're using a credit card, it's like you're giving someone your private key, but you're saying, hey, can you please only take how much money you asked that you said you're going to take, and then give me the private key back. But yeah, like I feel like it lowers the barriers to entry. And I certainly see situations where I'd be like, yeah, absolutely, I'll pay for this right now. Because anything in that sort of $1 to $10 range, you know, whether it's like a theme for a, you know, some WordPress theme, or whether it's a piece of music or whatever, you know, I could see a situation where it's like, I want that now, or I want that book, I want that thing, and I just click and buy. And it's just slightly different to like busting out a credit card. I feel like there's just a little bit less barriers there, and I feel like that in a way might actually unleash a more standard practice of just using Lightning to buy stuff and to unlock content online on you know, unlock things online that otherwise would have to be basically just free, which is cool as well in some cases. But I mean, if it is a commercial product and you want to sell it, you know, your economic incentives aren't going to be there if you can't sell it very easily. So it's actually going to help create more stuff and better stuff if there's easier ways to pay, perhaps.
Yeah. So there's two things there. It's a complete reversal, right? So Lightning payments are push payments; they're not pull payments. So you, as you said, you as the user are the one going to push a payment from your wallet to the service, not give information, you know, sensitive information about yourself to the service that, you know, you trust them, right, to do what they should, to be able to extract money from you whenever they want. That's really, really interesting, really powerful, I think. And yeah, well, I guess I already mentioned it really simplifies the development of applications as well. So that's really cool. The other thing we're really trying to focus on at Albi as well, as you said with the horse and the cart, you know, the internet changed, you know, the model of passing information from a broadcast model, like the TV, the radios, where you have one broadcaster who, it's very difficult. You have to be a large corporation with a lot of money, right, to broadcast to basically the entire country, to this, the internet model where everyone can broadcast to each other, right? But the problem is payments are still stuck in this broadcast world where you give your credit card information to a few select companies who will store it on the behalf of these applications. And you have to trust that these companies like Stripe or PayPal are going to take care of your credit card details and will facilitate the payments and also handle, you know, KYC. And there's censorship aspects there as well, you know, between the time the payment is made and it actually settles. That's where, you know, censorship can occur. That's where KYC is required. All these things, which people think, okay, you know, I'm as a consumer, I'm this gives me safety, right? But at the same time, they have complete knowledge of who is making the payment. If you deal with someone who might be a bit sketchy, maybe this payment is blocked, and I think it's only going to get worse with CBDCs. But I think that's another topic. But the main thing at Albi we're trying to do is bring value or money to the internet, basically. So being able to transfer value just as easy as being able to transfer information, which allows you to transfer value with every single user interaction, which is completely impossible in the legacy model, right? Because every single credit card transaction at the very least costs 30 cents. So how can you do micropayments, right? If every single payment, every single interaction costs 30 cents. Mm-hmm. And how do you do it if every single one of those transactions takes 60 days to settle? It's impossible. So yeah, with Lightning, you can really, really change how value is transmitted. That's why we think, you know, Bitcoin is the native currency of the internet and eventually the world, because, you know, it's open, borderless, permissionless, all these properties that just make it perfect, you know, open source, programmable money, you know, and I think all the incentives are aligned, which actually addresses a lot of issues we have today with content, you know, clickbait, all these articles that just try and draw you in so that you can see some ads so that the creator of the article gets revenue from the ads rather than actually creating quality content. There's so many things that, you know, Bitcoin improves over what we have today, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just, I mean, it's probably worth talking a little bit about, you know, the Albi And sort of what it actually is for people who maybe haven't used it before. I realize we've been talking a lot about what it is, but sort of how it works. You know, I've just got it open here in front of me, but at least from a desktop experience, you know, it's just an extension in Brave, or you know, in your browser, and you really just have this. I guess would you call it a Lightning wallet in your browser? How would you describe it?
The extension, yes,
Yeah.
But actually, LB does a whole lot more than that. So it's hard to describe. But basically, we believe Bitcoin is the native currency of the internet, and we're building tools, user interfaces, developer APIs, to make it as easy as possible for people to join the Bitcoin ecosystem and support the circular Bitcoin economy. So there's the extension, of course. Another thing is being able to connect your LB wallet to all these different applications. For example, Podcasting 2.0, you can listen to Cody's podcast, and every single minute you can stream sats. Like you can make payments every minute as you listen directly to Cody. We do a lot of work on open source protocols. So, you know, rather than these closed platforms like Twitter, Stripe, or PayPal, we focus on open protocols, which make it really easy for developers to build these apps that are interoperable. So that's, I guess that mostly covers what we're working on.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess my experience with it was, you know, using the extension, which I, you know, I use every day, I guess. But I didn't realize you had these other aspects to the company. I think, though, coming back to the extension, just the way it works and how easy it is, you know, I'm just always amazed at just, you know, you can you know, fire it up. I can you know, put some sats on it from my wallet on my phone, or I can withdraw from Stacking News, or I can withdraw from Fountain or some other place. And it's just this seamless experience. And I think it's kind of hard to describe to someone who doesn't really conceptualize what that means, but it's like you've got this system now that's totally open. Like anyone can build something that could send and receive on this Lightning network, and you know, you could send it to Albi, you could withdraw from Albi to something else that you've built, whether it's a game or some sort of app or some sort of service that you're selling, whatever it is, and you don't have to ask permission to do that. And I think that's really the big piece. Like, you know, I had the guy who built Swiss Bitcoin Pay on the show a couple of weeks ago, and that's sort of like a merchant app for, you know, cafes and, you know, retail shops. And I was just thinking, man, for him to build that same thing on like fiat credit card rails, you know, he'd have to go and like, oh, you know, get a permission from Visa. He'd have to go and talk to the bank and do all of this stuff. And just to even start developing. And it's like, look, the developers and the technical people are like, they're lining up waiting to build stuff. And you're like gatekeeping this network. It's sort of like, yeah, the internet analogy is quite apt. You know, you know, you've got people now who can run the newspaper, they can run a YouTube channel, they can run a blog, whatever, and it's totally decentralized. Well, not totally, I guess you've still got people like YouTube who are gatekeeping and to a degree, but compared to what it was like in the old days, you know, anyone can start a channel at least. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we haven't had that innovation with money. And just being able to send value to someone, I mean, I've seen it firsthand. I've seen, you know, again, having experienced it on the fiat side, where I've done buy me a coffee. I don't know if you know that website. It's sort of like a mini Patreon where you can like send someone a couple of dollars. I've had that. I've had Patreon. I've had Kickstarter, and they've all kind of worked somewhat okay. But there's still this sort of like hesitation because it's still having to go through the fiat rails. You can't do the microtransactions, and they are ultimately centralized, you know, like they've got fees they have to pay, they've got a lot of overhead. But I guess longer term, a lot of these systems, because it's open source, you know, the actual price or the cost of it is going to go closer and closer to zero, and there's going to be a plethora of options out there that you know, maybe that the fees that are actually being taken, you know, get less and less over time. I mean, Lightning routing fees are already pretty minuscule compared to what you pay on a transaction for a credit card. But I like what that unlocks just more broadly. And it's kind of an emergent thing that's quite hard to model. It's sort of like trying to, you know, guess what the internet would be like in 1990, you know, this kind of trajectory that it's heading on. But I don't know, like, what does it mean when everyone can just send and receive freely without censorship, without middlemen? Like, you know, what does that future look like?
Yeah, I think you have to think a bit further as well, right? What will the world be like on a Bitcoin standard?
Yeah.
I think the entire world is going to change in a really positive way, right? So,
well, yeah, man. I mean, you talk about Thailand. I mean, I've spent a bit of time there as well, and I just, it blows my mind. You know, you start thinking about like a charity. You know, I think in a fiat world, charity is delegated to, you know, we sort of assume the state is somehow going to look after that stuff. You know, there's a real lack of, I think, responsibility within society, just as individuals, for the well-being of others, which I think to a degree, you know, we're all humans, we're all social animals. And I think there is this this funny dichotomy where, even though Bitcoin is, you know, it's greedy money, you know, it's cryptographically secure, you can't take it. You get to that point, and then you ask the next question as well, is like, how do I help others? And this kind of, you move up, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, and self-actualization and kind of these kinds of questions. And I mean, I've got a UTXO set aside for Thailand one day. You know, there's my friend's doing some work with orphanages over there, and I'm like, yeah, it's not worth much at the moment, but one day I'll pay that into the future and see what happens. You know, I've got UTXOs set aside for certain things and certain people that I care about, and I want to see them succeed. And it's not, as I said, it's not a lot of sats at the moment, but one day, you know, it's sort of that will come to pass. And I think that kind of thinking, that philanthropy and stuff, is, you saw it maybe a little bit more in the golden age of capitalism, where you had, you know, these titans of industry putting money aside for things. But we've just delegated that to the state, and the state's not doing it. So it's sort of like we got these shitty organizations like UNICEF trying to like help, you know, help the world, but they're not even, you know, they're just taking all the money for themselves. Imagine just being able to send the money straight to the people, you know, and not even in like an aid sense, but it's like, look, we're gonna crowdfund on Geyser, this like water project in some country or some village. Boom, you can see the money, you can see it's all transparent, all legit. You can do it through your browser, you can send some sats. You know what I mean? Like, for me, that's also very exciting.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, right, you put some money aside, and just consider what would happen if you put this money in the bank, for example. 30 years from now, it's gonna lose 95% to 99% of its value. I think a lot of people don't understand that, right? And because of that, there's no long time preference thinking. So if we have, you know, sound money, we put this money aside now, and we can really do something great, you know, forego like immediate, you know, pleasure, I guess, in order to really create something worthwhile. The other thing that's interesting, right, is that you took responsibility of your own money. So you're not giving the keys to your money over to the bank and trusting that they are going to look after your money, because, you know, as Satoshi said, like, time and time again, trust has been broken, right? So the idea that re-educating like everyone in the world, that you should take responsibility for your own money, that's the first thing, right? And now with Nostra taking responsibility of keys to your own speech, that's the second thing. Those are the first, you know, the small roots, you know, the seeds to think, hey, oh, okay, what about health, right? Should I wear a mask? Should I stay at home? Should I, you know, stay in my little box, take some medicine and vaccines that the government sends to me, and I think I'll be healthy, right? It's like, no, you have to take responsibility for your health. And then what do you eat? What do you do in your spare time? It's the more responsibility people can take on, rather than outsourcing it to an external organization which can abuse that responsibility, the better for humanity in general.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of, I've been thinking about that a lot as I wander the streets of Tokyo, seeking out meaning, this kind of this balance between freedom and responsibility is something I'm always coming back to and drawn to. I've got somewhat of a degree of freedom with what I do now and the projects that I work on, but that comes with a great deal of responsibility. And I think you can't have one without the other. And even if you shun it, it still comes attached. And I think that's where we're heading, I think. And this is very positive. It's very optimistic to think that we're going to have more of this. And I don't think ultimately it will be for everyone. Just, there's a freedom to be irresponsible, perhaps. There will be always be people who don't fit into this, into the system. And again, that's just the nature of humanity. There'll always be contrarians who choose not to. But I think the general direction that's being set by thought leaders and by, the movers in society will be one of self-responsibility and just kind of, ethics and civics and these kinds of things, which, we've seemed to have lost somewhere along the way. And I'm excited for what that means. And certainly going to the Nostra Asia thing, man, I was so bullish on everything. I had played around with Nostra, a little bit, but I've certainly really taken another close look at it. And because basically it's unstoppable. It's like Bitcoin, man. It's a force of nature. You push it, you try and stop it somewhere, you try and choke it somewhere, and it will just sort of like go around you and like emerge in some other way. Hearing Jack Dorsey and Edward Snowden talk about just this moment that we're coming into with global censorship and everything. It was really quite a chilling, but also kind of optimistic talk about what our responsibility is to get to the freedom. What is the responsibility we need to take? Certainly gave me a lot to think about.
Yeah, I think everything has pros and cons. I mean, you have to put in more effort, but what you get out of it, it's like raising a kid or having a dog, right? It takes effort that you have to do every single day. You have to feed them, you have to look after them, but in the end, you get a lot of happiness from that, right? And I think the other thing is that the incentive structures are so much better. Maybe we have still some people who, don't want to, as you say, take responsibility for their own money, but they can give it to someone else in their community, which hopefully will, like, rather than it being segregated into these, these banks or these governments that everyone has to give, full trust in. I think the risk is going to be a lot more spread out.
So it was decentralized, and I think that's the key word. I mean, I think again, the daddy state, and this really comes through, is sort of it says that it's an abusive father, an abusive parent. Really, it says that it will do all these things, it makes all these promises, but then it's not there for you, and it lets you down constantly. And I think it's kind of like we're all the forgotten children of the state. We don't get any love. We give. We try to show our best and to do our best, but all we get is abuse and suffering at the hands of the state. And it is abusive because at least under some tyrannical like communist regime, it's like the state. It's a bad father, but in the West and where we're at today, we sort of still ascribe some goodness and we still give it the benefit of the doubt, even though it like locked us in our homes for 2 years. And I mean, you were unable to see your family. I was unable to see my family here in Japan. It was really traumatic. There was a few things that happened in those couple of years that were really quite difficult to deal with. And the most we can do, or the least we can do, is kind of acknowledge it. But I think I certainly feel a responsibility to make sure it doesn't happen again,
Yeah, and there's going to be new attack vectors every time.
Every time.
For example, UBI, right? Yeah. Universal Basic Income, which originally I thought was a great idea, right? Because if you think you're a creator, right? I'm a creator. I would like to have, you know, some funding where I can have time to work on my own products and eventually, you know, make my own money. But actually, when you think about it, UBI, what it basically means is that the society cannot sustain itself without the support of the government. And that's because the money that the government controls is basically, the value is destroyed, right? Over 30, 50 years, any money you have savings is worthless. And this money that you receive from the government, it's not yours, right? It's government controlled. They have full power over, well, they will with CBDC is what you can use it on. You know, there's going to be carbon credits. There's going to be limits. Like, if you don't spend your money within a certain time, then they'll just take it back from you. All these things that, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say UBI. I mean, it's universal basic idiocy, because what it does is, it's the abusive father that says, well, look, I'm not going to allow you to go to school. I'm not going to allow you to achieve your personal excellence, because every human is capable of something profound, which is the consciousness, the divine spirit, whatever you call it. But there's something in each of us that is able to achieve amazing things. And for each person, that might be something different. And, you know, objectively, some people will be able to do much, you know, much more than others, but there's still something that everyone can do. And I think to say that you're going to put people on an UBI so that they can play on their PlayStation and eat their fiat food in front of a big TV all day long is to put them into this like form of punishment, which if it was a prison with like bars and guards, you could at least lament your situation and perhaps write a book about it. But it's like a prison of the mind where you don't even let them see what's possible. And that's almost the worst kind of prison, because it's almost inescapable.
Yeah.
It's and I see it around me, man, honestly, like just the fear, the uncertainty, the doubt that everyone carries with them in this fiat world. It's like, where's the achievement? Where's the personal excellence, which is different for everyone, because for some people, just getting up in the morning is a big deal. And I mean that, you know, completely in earnest. You know, there's a lot of people with issues and challenges, which is totally fine. Not everyone is able to, you know, get up and make shit happen like amazingly. But to just have that motivation to do something, that's where humanity came from, is to like get up and do something, you know. And UBI, fiat, CBDC, all of this stuff is like, you know, get in the pod and lie down. It's like the complete opposite. Yep. You know, so yeah, it's a big thing we got ahead of us, Roland.
Yeah, it's as you mentioned right before, the hierarchy of needs actually is really depressing nowadays. Most people don't, you know, climb the first couple of steps, right? They're forced to work on something they don't enjoy, or the other option is they're living on, you know, the absolute crumbs basically. They don't work at all, and they have no power to improve their lives, right? So how do you get to, you know, the fifth step where, you know, you're working on something that gives you value, you have your own home, you have savings, you know, you have a community of friends that, you know, you love, and you get value from that. How do people, you know, climb these stairs? And the sad reality is that most people are still basically slaves today. And they just don't see it, right?
Yeah, they're wage slaves, as Marx would say. And I think that's coming back to what I was saying earlier. You know, there is also this idea that it needs to be purely economic. But if you go back to the Greek root of the word economics, around the management of the household, and that sort of thing, I think the idea of something like raising children, or doing charity work or volunteer work, or some of these things which don't have in our current fiat system, you know, they're not able to put a dollar on that. I think something like value for value or just the Bitcoin standard more generally, it kind of enables that kind of thinking. And as I just mentioned before, you know, I've got UTXOs, you know, set aside and labeled for the future for some charity work. I've got, you know, UTXOs set aside for family members and friends. And I think those kinds of things, that kind of charity work, you know, there's no economic transaction there. It's because I love these people and I want to support this stuff. And it's kind of, an enablement of the sort of the spiritual development, which in the fiat system is kind of dog eat dog, you know, and you know, you don't even know that it's like there's these big bank of dogs who are just eating everybody. But like, it kind of just takes the soul out of cities and places and people. And you know, I think I'm enjoying being back in Tokyo, but I'm certainly seeing it through a different lens compared to when I used to live here, because it was, you know, I didn't have this lens of Bitcoin to look at the way people just are rushing around, you know, trying to get from place to place. And I'm like, man, what are you guys all rushing around for? And it's, I mean, the answer is it's fiat, because everyone's got to pay their fiat bills and, you know, kind of sustain this beast, which I think there will still be aspects of that under a Bitcoin standard, but it will be a lot more holistic. It'll be like, yeah, I'm gunning to make something happen. Let's go. I want to be here. I want to do this. And it's a lot more healthy than like, oh shit, I have to do this, otherwise I'm going to sink to the bottom. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Work is one of the things that give people meaning in life, right? It's incredibly important. It's just that, as you say, the fiat beast, right? Basically, they can print as much money as they want. They can get value for free. Everyone else has to, you know, work harder and harder as hyperinflation happens, which it is going to happen, right?
It's depressing, man, because, I mean, Japan, I mean, there's been some stuff in the news around the yield curve control and some of that stuff. And, I mean, I actually, having been back here, I'm really beginning to feel like this might be one of the first big ones to really have some issues, because Japan's been in a difficult spot for like 30 years. But, man, you see, just because, I mean, they're beautiful, hardworking people, but they're like, they have to be hardworking, because there's no other way. You know, you slip through the cracks here and you're done for. And I think, man, that there's like a central bank somewhere that's causing all of this pain. And you know, this is the country of just the most beautiful sublime art, music, creative output. And a lot of that, it still happens despite this fiat beast existing right there that's kind of trying to eat it. But imagine what would flourish if we were under a Bitcoin standard here. Like, it's almost utopian. In fact, it is utopian, but it's also achievable in a way that I think a lot of other ideas have never really had an actionable kind of economic mechanism for achieving something beyond, oh, you just need to believe or whatever, you know. Like, it's like, no, you don't have to even believe, you just have to use Bitcoin and it's going to be okay. Like, there's something very exciting about that idea. And I don't know, I mean, that's why I'm starting, I'm doing this show, and it's why I'm having these conversations, because I'm trying to get my head around how it all happens and how it all works. But yeah, man, it's good stuff.
Yep.
I realize we've gone into some deep areas, Roland. I appreciate it. You've given me some ideas to bounce around with myself, actually. But what's next for you? You're working on Albi, in terms of like the business. Like, is there sort of releases or some big features that you're excited about within Albi that you can talk about? Or
we mainly just continuously try and improve the user experience, make it easier for both new people to come into the Bitcoin circular economy, and also enable existing businesses and new businesses to create applications that are powered by Bitcoin, or some businesses that already exist and, you know, support fiat rails like Stripe and PayPal. Bitcoin through the Lightning Network is an option that we can make as easy as possible for them to integrate. One we just did recently was cal.com. So it's like an open source, I think it's Calendly clone, right? But creators of these meetings can basically ask for, you know, the people who book their time to receive payments, right? So originally cal.com supported Stripe and PayPal. And so you can say, for this meeting, for this 1 hour, you need to pay me $10, $50, or whatever makes sense in your circumstance, right? And now we can do the same thing with Lightning, and there's no fees, right? So rather than the fees from Stripe or PayPal, Lightning is just an option, and we try and make it as easy to integrate, or easier than Stripe and PayPal. I think the more existing, you know, companies and businesses that start supporting Lightning, it's just going to make, you know, it's going to create a cascading effect. So we're doing all we can to improve the UX there, and also make sure that we can onboard, you know, the next million, billion users, because there's a lot of technical difficulties there, especially around self-custody, right? So how can we make self-custodial solutions that are just as easy for the user to use as some of the custodial solutions that are available? And the really important thing here is that the payment has to work, right? You can't have people, you know, trying out Bitcoin for the first time, first waiting 10 minutes. I mean, you know, that's what we did. Waited for 10 minutes and, you know, you get a nice, when the next block comes in, your transaction is sent. That's great, right? But for normal everyday people, the payment has to be instant. It has to be 100% reliable, all these things. And that's what our focus is. And again, we're trying to move towards a way where everyone can self-custody their Lightning, their Bitcoin on Lightning, because that's how it's really, you know, easy to use. And ways to also convert, you know, the Bitcoin in their Lightning wallet back to on-chain for long-term storage. All these things, there's so much that can be improved. And everything we do at Albi almost is open source. We have over 100 repositories on GitHub. So people looking, you know, to start contributing to Bitcoin. We have issues on there. We marked, you know, good first issue. If you're interested in learning how to program, or you're already a programmer but you don't have any experience, you can start contributing or ask how to contribute. We have a Telegram channel where we have, you know, a section for developers where you can ask any questions there. And also, as I mentioned, Bolt Fun is a really awesome way. I think that's, Albi is actually a really small team, and we work on so many projects. So we only have about 10 people. We have a lot of open source contributors, but there's so much work. And again, Bolt Fun, I think, really empowers people, because people need funding. They need initial motivation, right, to learn about Bitcoin. And once you understand it, you know it's superior basically in every single way. But how to get people started is still quite difficult. The more developers, the more artists, UX designers, the better solutions we can create for the entire world.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. I really respect the work you guys are doing. I think it's great. And something that sort of stuck with me from the Nostra Asia conference, I was talking to somebody about how we're kind of in this race, as I said before, to build things. We're in this race to onboard the world, and there's still a lot of work to do. There's still a lot of stuff that needs to be done. And it's like you meet the people in real life and you realize, man, it's still a pretty small group of people building this infrastructure, and we're all putting in 150% in whatever our chosen field is, you know, whether it's you know, design, development, or, you know, sort of the stuff I'm doing around podcast and educational work. But there's always something that you can contribute and be part of. And there is definitely a race to build this stuff. Not that I'm trying to worry too much about that. I've got to keep the eye on the goal, but man, we've got a lot ahead of us, but you guys are helping with that, and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your time, Roland. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no worries. And I just like to emphasize what you mentioned, that there's work everywhere, no matter what you do, right? No matter if you're a developer, an artist, you create content, we need help in all areas. So if you're interested, the main thing, you know, you just need to put in the work. And if you're interested in joining a team, working with like-minded individuals, then these hackathons like Bolt Fun are a really great way to join the community. And also, you know, going to conferences around the world, especially Bitcoin-only conferences, which are a trend happening in the last few years, is a really great development, I think.
Yeah, sweet. Well, hey, look, I appreciate your time, Roland. I'm keen to keep in touch. I might be able to catch up with you in Thailand sometime when I'm over there, or if you ever make your way over this way. I'm sort of not sure what my travel plans will be in the next little while, but I'm sure we can try and sync something up. It'd be great to catch up in person and talk a little bit more about some of these ideas, man.
Definitely.
Cool.
Thanks for your time on the show. Yeah, great to be a part of it.
No, thank you. Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you'd like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you.